My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Thank you for joining me for episode 8 of Mysteries and Monsters. Today we dive into one of my favourite subjects in cryptozoology, lake monsters. I'm sure for many of us, our interest probably can be traced back to one cultural point, the surgeon's photo taken in 1933. That iconic image is easily one of the most recognisable in this subject and makes Nessie probably the most famous monster in the world. Yet despite it being a hoax, perpetuated by Marmaduke Weatherall, the love of lake monsters has continued to grow. From Ogopogo, Bessie and Memphrey in Canada, to Mayuso in Colombia and Lago Saro in Italy, people claim to see monsters inhabiting bodies of water they have no business being seen in. In Lake Champlain, stories of a creature living in the lake date back to the tribes of the Iroquois and Abenaki, and the sightings have numbered over 300. It was a photo captured by Sandra Mansi in 1977 that finally brought Champ into the spotlight, and a modern phenomena was born. Today I'm joined by Katie Elizabeth, head of Champ Search. Katie has made it her life's work to find Champ. We discuss her work, her sightings, and what the future holds for Champ. Don't forget you can join us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and YouTube. The podcast is now on all platforms. And please support us on Patreon. Enjoy. Right, my guest today is Katie Elizabeth. Katie has developed a renowned reputation in the field of cryptozoology for her work regarding Champ, Lake Champlain's legendary cryptid. Katie has been recognised as the world's only dedicated female lake monster hunter, successfully earned protected status from the town of Port Henry for Champ, which is known as the home. You've also released a book, Water Horse of Lake Champlain, and you've had numerous TV, podcast and documentary appearances, most recently in the Small Town Monsters on the Search for Tramp. So, Katie, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, I am as well, because lake monsters are a big passion of mine. I love them.
Yeah, it's my obsession. So, like I was telling you earlier, I'm always out on the lake every day unless, you know, the weather's not good or it's really windy out and raining. But even in the rain, I've pretty much, you know, stuck it out and roughed it a little bit. And, you know, a lot of hours on the lake, which is key to having any experience. It takes a lot of time and dedication, and it's like watching paint dry. I have to say that. It really is.
Well, yeah, I think that's the problem with when it comes to monster hunting is the key thing, I think, for anybody involved in this field is patience.
Absolutely. And I'm also an angler. I fish a lot, and it's pretty much like that. You know, you're sitting and, you know, it's amazing how just sitting there and staring at a body of water can wear you out. Like my eyes sometimes hurt. And, you know, if it's really, really sunny out, I have to shut my eyes for a few seconds just to give my eyes a break. It's just one of those things. I figure if I look away for a second, sure enough, one's going to pop up and it's going to be too late. They're very, very fast when they do. So, yeah.
Excellent. So, firstly, thank you for being my first female guest as well. And obviously, the world of cryptozoology is mostly a male-dominated area, as I'm sure you and I are both fully aware. So
Yes.
what on earth?
There's gonna be a
Oh.
tree. There's gonna be a train going by in a minute, so if it gets really loud, you'll know why, because it's right behind my house.
Oh,
So it'll
excellent.
probably last at least like 8 seconds. And
No, I've
it's
just
actually
heard
gonna be
it.
going by in a few seconds. Yeah, it's pretty loud. That's the only thing where I live. That I remember the first time I moved here. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, and it went by, and it scared the heck out of me. I was like, "Oh my God, what is that noise?" He's not
Absolutely.
blowing the horn yet. He's not blowing the horn yet, but oh, it's not the horn happy conductor. He's annoying. He'll go by, beep, 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 woo, 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 and I'm like, oh my God, be quiet. So I think
Brilliant.
we're good. I don't think he's gonna blow the horn anymore, so we're
Oh,
good.
right, no problems. So, how on earth did you end up finding yourself at Lake Champlain? What got you obsessed with Champ?
Well, it started when I was 7. I was watching an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and that was when Unsolved Mysteries was hosted by Robert Stack, which, I mean, he made the whole show, his animated voice, that, and the creepy music always, it still freaks me out if I hear the theme song for that. And I was watching that, and I saw the famous photo that Sandra Mansi had snapped in 1977 of Champ. And I said to my mom, I said, "Mom, there's a dinosaur in Vermont on Lake Champlain." And she's like, "What in the world are you watching?" And she's like, "What in the?" And she goes, "Wow, that's interesting." So I said, "Mom, can we go there for a trip?" And she's like, "Well, how far away is it?" I'm like, "I don't know." So I pulled out the old Rand McNally map, which is what we used back in the day before we had GPS. And I kind of calculated that it would be at least 5 hours away. And she's like, "Oh, geez, that's really far. We'll go at some point." She kind of just told me that to pacify me, I'm sure. So it wasn't until 2012. I was watching a lot of documentaries on the lake monsters and stuff. And after I had that, experience of seeing the Mansi photo, I actually went to my local library in my elementary school to see if they had any books on Champ or Nessie. There was one book on Champ back then. It was Champ Beyond the Legend by Joseph Czarzynski. So I took that book out and I asked the librarian if, what there was for Nessie books. I can't quite remember which books that I took out on Nessie, but she looked at me like I had two heads. She's like, "Lake monsters?" I'm like, yeah." So that was, I studied Champ and Nessie and Ogopogo and all the other lake monsters around the world my whole life. But like I said, it wasn't until 2012 I was watching some documentaries and I said, "I really need to get up there." And I just had this mag, this, how do I put it? It was like a magnet for me. I'm like, I have to get there. I have to go up there and see if I have an experience. I never really thought that I would. I said, "Well, that's probably just wishful thinking." And in 2012, I came up here for a trip, and on my second day here, I had my first sighting. So that kind of creeped me out because I was like, "Wow!" Like, people have lived around this lake for 30, 40 years and have never seen a thing, and I'm up here for 2 days, and kaboom! So, and that's when I started my organization, Champ Search, and started spending all my money on equipment and getting out there and just trying to explain what I had seen. It was just amazing. It really was. So it, to me, it was my life calling that the what I'm doing today.
So, in regards to living in Champlain, how long have you lived around there now?
I have been living here almost 2 years. And before that, I started coming up here in 2012, every 2 to 3 weeks, to do investigations and stuff. And I would stay with a friend of mine and do it that way. But it got to the point where it was so much driving, and I'm like, this is crazy. Like, 4.5, 5 hour drive, it does wear you out. So I said, finally I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna start looking at houses up there and find something in my research area, because a lot of people say, oh, do you live in Burlington? But that's a city. I'm not a city person. So where I live, there it's basically the country, a lot of cow farms, around the lake, and a lot of marsh systems as well, which we'll probably get into later about some of the marsh sightings of Champ, which I find completely fascinating. I've never had that opportunity to see a Champ animal on land, and that's one of my goals. So.
Yeah, fantastic. So, I mean, as you say, I mean, Champ's one of, for me, it's probably the second most famous lake monster out there because, everybody knows about Nessie. And I was actually talking to Alexander last week, because he's actually been to Loch Ness, and his first real documentary that he made himself was about Nessie. I mean, Champ for me has always been the one that I've leaned to more in regards to that I think that there's clearly something strange going on in Lake Champlain.
Yes, it's the most amazing thing is you would think that there'd be more coverage on Champ, because there's so much more evidence. I mean, I love Nessie, don't get me wrong, and I do plan on getting to Loch Ness hopefully next year. I was going to this year, but my funds kind of didn't turn out the way I wanted them to, so that is on my bucket list next year. But with Champ, there's so much evidence. I mean, God, I have 4 or 5 different videos. Some of them I haven't even published yet online. I've got them on my hard drive, and there's some of them where there's like an hour or two of nothing with the camera just sitting there. So I have to do some editing to like crop out that part and stuff. And then also the echolocation recordings. Elizabeth von Muggenthaler, who used to come up here to the lake, she had gotten a few recordings of echolocation, and then she stopped coming up. I guess it was just for personal reasons. Really don't know where she is at the moment. Been actually trying to find her, but with no luck. So I decided to take over and start doing the recordings myself. And it was 2014, I got my first recording of echolocation in an area of the lake called Scotch Bonnet. And that was around 7:30 p.m. in July. So the area where we were sitting is like a really big hot spot. There's actually like a mound that's right near that rock that they call Scotch Bonnet, and I think that's a prime feeding area, because when you have the mounds in the lake and the ledges, those are filled with a lot of perch and smelt, basically a Champ buffet. So those are the areas I believe they act as an ambush predator. Yeah, and they've got that really long neck to snap their prey. It's pretty neat. So I mean, there's certain places in the lake where there's been more sightings than others. And to the most common belief with Champ or Nessie is that they're this 100-foot-long monster. And that's what throws people off and makes them say, oh, well, I think that's just a bunch of baloney. I don't believe that there is something that big in the lake. And that's what makes it sound, not believable. And in fact, Champ is usually 15 to 20 feet on average in length. And I've heard of a couple of stories of an individual seeing one that was around 30 feet, which is actually the largest that I've ever heard of. I've never seen one that large, but it would scare the heck out of me. And one particular sighting, it was very, very close to the eyewitness. So and she didn't have a camera, but I mean, if something like that happened to me, yeah, I don't know. I think I'd be running for the hills, but I try not to, because I'm like, wait a minute, let me take your video and picture first. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Elizabeth because that's probably the first real documentary I saw about Champs about 15 years ago. Unoriginally titled America's Loch Ness, and Elizabeth's in it because I think, wasn't she part of an organisation called the Fauna Communications Research Institute?
Yes. She actually lives in North Carolina, and she would come up here maybe once a year, not very often, maybe twice a year, to do research and stuff. And I actually worked with her for a while, and we didn't get any recordings. Unfortunately, at the time, I didn't have a boat, and she didn't have access to a boat like she did on the documentary. So we were just kind of puttering around the lake and going to different spots and just throwing the hydrophone in from the shore, which the particular hydrophone that she had was very, very powerful. So, I mean, it could record, I think it was up to at least 4 miles. So if anything was around in the areas that we were just kind of tossing it in offshore, we would have picked something up. But also, we weren't really going to these locations at the right times either. There are certain times that I've had luck in having a sighting or getting a recording. And those are the times that, I'll go out on the lake, usually between 7 and 8:30 at night is a perfect time. And that's when the fish are out feeding on the bugs. So that's, that's one of the times. And I've never really had much luck like early in the morning, but I've heard of sightings very early at, sunrise, sunset, and around noontime as well, because the sun is at its peak. So when that happens, and with my belief of these animals being an ectotherm, they need that vitamin D and that warmth to sustain their core temperature, unlike warm-blooded animals or like us. So they love basking in the sun. There's a lot of reports of them sunbathing on the beach, basically like up on top of the, just like a turtle would. I mean, they act very much like a turtle, but without a shell. So, and a very long neck.
Yeah, I mean that documentary when it came out was quite incredible, really, because there aren't many creatures that make the sounds that were caught. So it was clearly even if it's not related to the Champ situation, the fact that recordings of that nature are being made in Champlain is different anyway, because there is no creature, a whale or a type of dolphin that's supposed to reside there either, is there?
No, the funny thing is, I mean, 10 to 12,000 years ago, this area was once the Champlain Sea. So it was an arm of the ocean. And this area was home to beluga whale, seals, walruses. And what's really interesting is that I think that you saw my paper that I did. Well, it's actually 56 pages long. But I did a study on the echolocation that I have gotten compared to beluga whale. So I went to a aquarium called Mystic Aquarium in the state of Connecticut, and I sat by the tank, and I couldn't drop my hydrophone in because they probably would have thrown me out of the aquarium, because there were signs, do not put anything into the tank. And I'm like, oh darn, what am I gonna do? So my hydrophone's powerful enough, and it's small, it's like compact. So I had my purse there, and I'm sitting by the tank on the cement ground, and it was freezing out. It was December. I'm like, oh my gosh, my bum is getting really cold, but this is worth it. So I put the microphone up to the tank, and I was like, I wonder if this is gonna work, because it was a very obviously very thick glass tank. And all of a sudden, I start hearing them vocalize. They're like, and they're talking away, and I'm like, oh my God, it's working. This is awesome. So I did quite a bit of recording. I think I did like 1 or 2 hours. And what was amazing about it, there was one particular form of echolocation that they were doing that was like a very low frequency pulsating. And when I heard that, like the hair in the back of my neck stood up, because it was very similar to one of the recordings that I had captured in the lake. So I was like, wow. So, I mean, I don't believe that this population in Lake Champlain is any sort of cetacean, because we would be seeing them all the time. They would obviously be more social. But I believe with these animals being in this area, as long as this was the Champlain Sea, they were sharing, the area with the beluga whales. So who's to say that they weren't, picking up this echolocation type of capability, whether it would be to, compete for food, which, that's kind of debatable, or in my opinion, maybe for social interaction with the beluga whales.
Yeah, very much so,
Um,
because
because we don't know, because we don't know if ancient amphibians or reptiles could echolocate. So that's just a guess, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's the famous whale, beluga whale skeleton that was unearthed, wasn't there? Was that 1850? Is it the Charlotte
Yeah,
whale they call it?
yes, 1849, and that is actually about 5 minutes from my house where they found that.
Wow, I mean that was
So,
when they were digging up the railroad, wasn't it?
yes, and they thought it was actually a skeleton of a horse or an ox because the head was so long looking. And then they finally got a hold of a naturalist named Zadok Thompson, and he said, no, this is a beluga whale. And they're like, wow. So that shows right there what a diverse ecosystem at that time this was. I mean, it was thriving with whales and walruses, and I mean, there's been seal skeletons found as well. A lot of ancient coral fossils. I found quite a few gastropods down right near my house, actually. And they're set right in the rock. They look like an ammonite, but they're quite different. They don't have the ridges in between. But yeah, it's really amazing to go around the lake and find all these neat fossils. And I mean, it just shows how old this area really is.
Fabulous. I mean, like you say, I mean that is the one thing that links really Champ and Nessie together is the fact that they were both originally connected to the sea. But in regards to Champlain, has it become fresh water over the years, or?
Well, I mean, it's completely fresh water now. There is an indirect way to the St. Lawrence Seaway up in Canada, but it's indirect. There's a dam there and everything, so it's not directly connected anymore. But up in the St. Lawrence Seaway, there is still a population of beluga whale, which is really interesting. I do need to get up there eventually and do some recordings in the Richelieu River, which is indirectly connected. That would be really interesting.
Yeah, I mean that's fascinating because that alone shows that the beluga whales have been using that area for at least 10,000 years.
Yeah, it's definitely amazing. And I remember I had this really strange prophetic dream. Well, I tend to have those now and then, and they freak me out. I had this dream. I was back home in Rhode Island because that's where I'm from. And I was recording out in the ocean. Like, it was actually the first place that I had lived in Rhode Island when I was a child. And we lived right on the ocean. And I was recording beluga whales. And I'm like, what in the world? So I wake up and I'm like, that was a weird dream, you know? So I swear, 5 days later, I'm watching the news, and they said, oh, beluga whales have been sighted in Appanag Cove. And that's exactly where I used to live. And they were, hundreds and hundreds of miles from the St. Lawrence Seaway. I'm like, whoa, they followed me home. It was amazing. And I was just, wow, I was totally amazed that they had come down that far to Rhode Island. I mean, that's a long trip. And sometimes juvenile beluga whales will travel to follow food sources, and they will also go into fresh water to shed their dead skin, which is interesting. But they cannot live in fresh water for a very long time. So, it's important that they get back out to the salt water, which these guys did, thank God. I think there was a pod of four or five, from what I remember. And they went back home to the St. Lawrence Seaway, and I was just like, wow, that is just so weird that I had that dream. Because that's unheard of, for them to go that far. It does happen very rarely. And when it does happen, I think, maybe with it getting warmer, the earth's changing, I think a lot of animals are affected by, the wonky weather lately. One minute it's 70 here, and the next minute it's 30. So
Sounds like
it's
England.
crazy. You never know what to wear. You never know what to wear.
It definitely sounds like England to me. So, I mean,
Yes.
the one thing about Champ as well is that we've got, it's not just a modern phenomenon, because obviously we've got reports going all the way back to the original tribes in the area. So apologies for my pronunciations. So you've got the Abenaki tribe and the Iroquois, who both referred to a creature known as Tatascock, I believe. So obviously, you know, that predates obviously Champlain turning up and naming the lake after himself, which I think is rather modest of him in the very least. So I mean, that alone shows that this just isn't a modern phenomenon.
Now, I mean, these stories of Champ go back to the Native Americans that were around the lake, and they actually did worship the horned serpent, as they called it. It or well, there's more than one, but they would also say that there were snakes in the lake, like giant. They referred to them as serpent snakes, very similar to the stories of Ogopogo. That the Native Americans over there had this, it's just amazing to have these stories that are, you know, they're supposed to be just legends, but I mean, how would they know the Native Americans over here? You know what I mean? I mean, it's just fascinating how they were having the same experiences and worship them as well. And a matter of fact, they would go across the lake in their canoe, and then they'd throw in offerings of tobacco to appease Champ. I don't think Champ really liked tobacco, but maybe it was chicken wings or something like that. It would be a different story, but that was their belief. So, yeah, it is fascinating to look at that. And what's cool too is the stories of the horned serpent. And you go, you know, over at Loch Ness, you have the stories of Nessie having horns. And in my paper, I actually talk about that, where I do believe that these animals are, I'm leaning towards amphibian more than reptile, or they could be a hybrid of both. I mean, I really don't know, but they have these traits of reptile or amphibian. And with the amphibian, they actually, you know, a lot of salamanders and newts have these knobs on the top, well, kind of behind their eye on each side, almost basically on the top of their head, kind of set in that position. And they're called parotid glands. And the parotid glands are made to basically deter predators. So it's basically, they secrete a pungent odor. And what's really interesting about that is there's a lot of stories of Champ that they smell really, really bad. So that could be what these structures are on the top of their head. They're not horns. They're, in my opinion, they're possibly parotid glands. So I found that interesting in my studies to find that out, because I do remember there are quite a few stories of people locally seeing these animals in the marsh or hearing them thrashing through the marsh at night. And I'm sure that they're feeding at that time. There's a lot of goodies out there at night. You know, you get snakes, frogs, little fish in the marsh. So it's a really good feeding area for them. So, and then, you know, you get the stories of them. Oh God, this odor was very, very musky and pungent. And that's exactly what, you know, those parotid glands smell like when they're secreting. So that's just an idea of what they possibly could be.
I mean, there's enough, you know, strange creatures in the world of fish and amphibians. You know, there are catfish that can walk from pool to pool. You know, like, you know, as you say, salamanders. I've seen octopuses walk from pool to pool. So I'm always perplexed when people say, "Oh well, it can't possibly be coming on shore because there's nothing that does that." Yet we know for a fact that there are several, you know, types of fish that do so.
Yes. And then the thing is too, you know, a lot of, you know, with the cetacean theory as well, it's like, okay, a whale's not going to come up in the marsh. They're not going to be running across the road. There's a major road over in New York named 9N, very much like Loch Ness. You know, the road's right next to the lake. And one particular evening, I believe this was 1993 or 1994. I never did get the date quite right when I heard this story. It was one of those stories, you know, you hear from this person, this person, this person, and you're like, okay, what date was it? Well, it was sometime in the early 90s. So, But what was interesting about that sighting was the guy was driving down the road, and a champ animal ran right across the road and right into the lake. And that sounded very much like the Spicer account at Loch Ness, and also Arthur Grant's sighting at Loch Ness of him on his motorcycle. So,
Is
the
the Spicer sighting the one where they see it go across the road with a sheep in its mouth?
Yes. Yep. And it's funny because there's a lot of stories here at Champlain from the 1800s where people were saying that their cattle were being dragged down to the lake, sheep, you name it. And I'm like, that's interesting because the thing is with Champ, I don't know. I mean, they have a fairly large head. It looks just like a horse's head. And I mean, it's one of those things, they could take a chunk out of something, but I don't really know if they would be going after cattle or sheep or anything like that. I really don't know. It's kind of a little bit elaborate, but hey, at that time in the 1800s, the lake, there was a lot of tanneries on the lake, and there was a lot of pollution getting into the lake. So maybe that was depleting their food source of fish. And with being a reptile or amphibian, they can go up to a year and a half without food. And they're fine, which is amazing. So the whole idea with scientists saying that, oh, there's not enough food in Loch Ness or Lake Champlain. Well, yeah, if you're dealing with a mammal species, you're correct because they need food constantly to sustain. But these animals, I believe, they'll come up and go after school of fish or, do that here and there, and that's when you have your sightings of them coming up to the surface after a school of fish. But yeah, I don't think that they eat constantly like they're made out to be, to sustain. And that makes a lot of sense because otherwise, and not just that, they have been in the food web this whole time, so they're built into the food web anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things because frogs can go into suspended animation if things are getting bad for them. You've got lizards that can reproduce without males. The
Yes.
animal kingdom is constantly gives us strengthening cases for certain creatures living where they shouldn't. And I'm always not annoyed, but I'm always a little bit perturbed when you hear people say, oh well, it can't be this because the population that there is, they can't breed, or well, the food, like you've just referred to there, the food there isn't enough food, it's too scarce for to su sustain creatures like that. But we know in the animal kingdom that animals adapt.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there are Komodo dragons that were, I think there was one particular female in a zoo that was, actually asexual. She was, reproducing without a mate. So that's interesting in itself. And who's to say that they can't do the same thing? We really don't know.
Yeah, well, if chickens can do it, anything's possible.
And a lot of people ask, if I go to a seminar, have a seminar or something, they'll ask, well, do you believe that they lay eggs or they give live birth? And that is a good question. I know with plesiosaurs, which I personally don't believe that Champ or Nessie is a plesiosaur. That's just my opinion. But I mean, heck, I'm open to many ideas. I'm not one of those people who's like, well, this has to be this, if I knew all the answers, we would have solved the mystery by now. But I'm just going by all the eyewitness reports to form an identikit, all the features and behavioral patterns of these animals. But I believe that they possibly give live birth. And what's really interesting is ancient amphibians and reptiles were known to give live birth. And I didn't know that amphibians gave live birth because when you think of an amphibian, you think of them laying eggs in the water, like frogs do. And yeah, that's not the case with the ancient amphibian species. So I found that fascinating as well. But yeah, I mean, if they did lay eggs, I'd like to find one and get an incubator. I just hatched out my own champ. It
Well, that'd
would
certainly
be
be
very much like
something.
the water horse movie. Yes.
I
It would
think
be
that.
like proof Russo in the Water Horse movie in the bathtub, you know?
Very true. Yeah, I think that would put any argument to bed. But I think that's the best way to look at it, really, is to not, you know, too many times. I think, you know, as specifically with Nessie, everybody thought it was a plesiosaur, despite all the evidence saying, you know, that if it is anything, it's probably not a dinosaur. And I think the best way to look at cases like Champ and Ogopogo and others is to not rule anything out until you know for a fact it's not a specific thing.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in my opinion, whatever these animals are, I just like my own personal belief is that they are an unknown species of giant amphibian with a long neck. I just don't believe it's anything that we've found in the fossil record because I've done so much research in trying to look at ancient amphibians and reptiles and try to compare what they look like to some of these. I mean, they look very much like a plesiosaur, but there's animals out there that look like other animals and that they're not even related. So it's, you know, it's one of those things. And with the sounds as well, you know, with the echolocation, there's another researcher, I don't say names on the radio, but who does a little bit of research, he'll come up once a year or something. And he had said that my recordings were fish farts. And I'm like, what? Because, you know, fish do expel gas. They do expel gas. And I have recordings of it. It's basically, that's what it sounds like, a fart. And I was like, are you kidding me? And it was kind of funny. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. But sometimes, as you know, in cryptozoology, you get that. If that person wasn't the one to record what you have or get that video, it's unfortunate because that's not the way I am. I don't downplay anybody's evidence or anything like that because I just don't. I don't take that road, you know. I think people need to like work together and not get such a competitive thing going on. Unfortunately, that does happen, as you know.
Yeah, very much so. I think the thing
But
with
with
oh, go on, sorry, Katie.
that's okay. With the recordings, though, I mean, I do so many recordings out in the lake of known animals, sturgeon, fish farts, perch, you know, all the different species of fish, and also man-made sounds, you know, boat motors, things like that. And none of that compares to what I have gotten or what Liz von Muggenthaler had recorded either. So, you know, I do my research as far as biology and ichthyology with the fish in the lake. Like I said, I also fish myself, and my favorite fish to catch is actually called a bowfin, and they go back 100 million years, ancient fish. So, I mean, to think of, you know, Champ, you know, a population being in the lake that some people would say it's absurd. Well, you look at the ancient fish in the lake that are still here. We have bowfin, we have gar, and we have sturgeon. And those animals have survived 100 million years. I mean, come on. That shows you right there how I am sure that there's more than Champ in that lake that we haven't discovered yet. You know, who the heck knows? I mean, it's a very big lake. It's 120 miles long and 400 feet deep at the deepest. So anything could be in there. Plenty of room, that's for sure.
Yeah, very true. And you know, it's only, what is it, 70, 80 years since we found the coelacanth, which was completely ruled
Yes.
out. You know, the people from, you know, off the coast of Africa and Madagascar, the locals were all making it up. Nobody believed them. And then a British scientist caught one, and then, oh, lo and behold, oh yeah, they do exist.
Yeah, see, it's amazing. It's, you know, we're discovering new species all the time. I mean, especially in our oceans, 98% of the ocean is unexplored. That is just crazy. We know more about space than our own oceans,
Absolutely. I mean,
which I
think.
don't.
Oh, go on. It's
Just gonna, sorry about that.
all
No,
right.
I just don't understand that. You'd think that they would spend more money in, you know, researching our own oceans. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, things are turning up all the time. I was looking at a report the other day. There's a British guy who's gone to the bottom of a trench in the Pacific, and He filmed two species that had never been seen before. One essentially looks like a plastic bag floating along, but it's not. It's some kind of amoeba or jellyfish. That had never been seen till last week.
Oh, that's amazing. I don't think that I saw that, but I will check it out. That's
I'll send you
amazing.
the link later.
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
It's really fascinating because he's down on the sea floor, and this thing just comes wandering along. I think it comes for a look more than anything, and then it just wanders off again.
Wow, that's great. I can't wait to see that. That'll be an interesting read for sure.
Absolutely. Well, I've built it up now, so you better be impressed.
I'm sure I will be.
So, looking at obviously your work and what you've done. In regards to some of the more famous sightings over the years going back, whilst people have been seeing things at Champlain, I mean, because I was really interested to see that sort of 1883 was kind of like a hot year for Champ, because there's about three really well reported stories that I just find fascinating.
Yes, the 1800s for some reason were like basically booming. There was a lot of stories. Matter of fact, one of the stories was in Charlotte, Vermont, which is, like I said, around 5 minutes away. That's where the Charlotte whale skeleton was found. There was a party of picnickers, and they said they didn't drink any more than lemonade. So they were out on the shore, kind of having a picnic, and all of a sudden, a champ animal came out of the water and just was going crazy. It was running around and frolicking around where these people were picnicking. And of course, they're all screaming and it made a heck of a ruckus. And I was like, wow, if I was there, I mean, I don't know what kind of cameras they had back then. Probably those like crank cameras, you know? I'd be over there trying to like crank the camera. Oh, I think I got it. Oh, God, run. But that was a weird, really weird report. I mean, to have one come up on shore and run around like crazy. I don't know if it had something wrong with it or he ate bad fish. I have no idea, but that was an interesting story. And then there was also another story down in Dresden, New York, which is probably, I'd say, an hour and a half from here. And down in this area of Dresden, there is extensive marsh systems, and there are quite a few stories. One in particular, there was I can't remember his name, but there was a captain of a boat, and he was out near this marsh, and he saw one basically curled up taking a nap on the shoreline, and he shot at it, poor thing, and it took off in the brush. So, I mean, there was reports in the 1800s of, some being shot and, the animal popping out of the water, and they're shooting at it with rifles, and then there was blood, and then the animal was gone. I mean, it may not have killed it. I don't know. It could be like with American alligators. There's a certain area on the top of their head that when people go alligator hunting, you have to shoot the animal in that spot, or you don't kill it. You just wound it. So I'm wondering if they're the same way, and if, being a primordial species, anything primordial seems to be extremely tough when it comes to survival. That's why they're still here. I mean, with the bowfin fish that I go fishing for, I don't personally eat them myself, but I have heard of people chopping their heads off and they're flopping around for hours at a time. And they can also live out of water for 2 or 3 days, which is very strange too. And with snapping turtles, if someone cuts their head off, their head will keep snapping for days on end. And that's why if anybody kills a turtle for soup or whatever, they'll bury the head because, you don't want to go near that head. The reflexes are still going. So it's very, very strange
Yeah, I
with
mean,
that.
It's one of those things, like I say, I mean, the other sighting that I've always found fascinating about Champ was the steamboat, the W.B. Eddy, that apparently hit it.
Yes. Yes, that was a pretty amazing story as well. And there's been other stories here and there throughout history where they have come into collision with boats. And I think I heard one from Liz von Muggenthaler, matter of fact, and I'm not sure what year it was, but there was a boat out in the lake. They hit something and they went back to see where it went, whether the animal took off or whatever. We really don't know. But I mean, the thing is, with their buoyancy, I would think, like the American alligator, if they go out and, you know, shoot alligators, like I watch Swamp People. It's a show here in the U.S. where they go out alligator hunting. And if they shoot one, they have to get out there pronto, because if they don't, they sink right to the bottom.
Yeah.
So I believe that they have the same, I believe they're very, very muscular, and anything with a lot of muscle is going to sink to the bottom. So that's, you know, probably why we're not finding any type of body laying around. And you know, how many dead turtles you find around either. It's one of those things, nature has a way with decomposition and things like that. But I'm sure in the marsh system or in the lake somewhere, there are skeletons. But it's so difficult to find, because in the marsh, it's all mud. I mean, they could have this instinct where they know that they're dying and kind of bury themselves in the mud, and that's where they are. I mean, there could be hundreds of skeletons out in the marsh system, because our marsh system around Lake Champlain is over 300,000 acres.
Wow.
Which is massive. I mean, in these places, people have never explored. I'm the only crazy nut who goes out in a canoe in some of these places. And I mean, it's kind of scary. And I'm like, maybe I need a handgun, because, I mean, it's one of those things, they're not harmful to people. But if you cornered one, just like any other animal, you don't know what they might do. So it is scary, especially at night, too, because I've gone out at night searching and, oh, it's very eerie. And I don't go alone. So just in case something happens, just in case.
Yeah, I mean, dark nights on the water will always remind me of Jaws, and the famous scene where they're having a little chat and a drink, and then all of a sudden it all kicks off. So I know where you're coming from there. I wouldn't want to be out and about on my own, and I think you're best off making sure you are protected, regardless of your intentions. You've just got to be safe, Katie.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, being out on the lake at night, it's really funny, because I remember my partner at the time that was doing Champ stuff with me, he was out on the boat with me, and I said, hey, let's stay overnight and drop the hydrophone down in the underwater camera, which the underwater camera is one of those things. It depends on where you are on the lake. And in the summertime, the clarity most of the time is not good. I mean, it's not as murky as Loch Ness. We don't have peat content here, but the blue green algae is quite a problem, and the water is very green.
Yeah.
So, you know, the chance of something swimming by and getting a good video of it is very slim, which is kind of sucky, because that would be amazing to get an underwater video of Champ. But with the hydrophone, it's basically a non-invasive way to just listen. And I do a lot of sitting, because I'm not buzzing around in my boat constantly. So I'll go to, like, I'll plot out a map and say, okay, we're going to hit this location and record for 2 or 3 hours, and then we can hit this other location and record as well. And I basically go to all the hot spots where there's been sightings by eyewitnesses or myself. Like I said, I do have some videos. So I try to stick to the same places, and it really has proven to, you know, be successful, because of the recordings that I've obtained. And one night, we were out in Button Bay, where I've gotten some of my videos, and we started getting recordings. And it was really, really scary, because it was starting to get dark, and there was three individual voices. You could hear three individuals. So there was like this low grumbling, like that, and then you hear another one and another one, and then back to that other voice again. And it was like you could tell that they were different tones. So in my opinion, it was possibly three different animals down, you know, on the bottom of the lake, because in that area, it's around 30, it's not that deep, 30 feet feet to 60 feet in some areas. And the lower that I put my hydrophone mic down, the louder they got. So that indicated to me that they were basically kind of, I would think, kind of walking on the bottom. And whether that vocalization was, you know, it could be for breeding. I think it was something to do with territorial, because, I mean, some of the rumbling got so loud that the external speaker hooked up to the hydrophone almost blew up on me. So I had to turn that down. And then my partner at the time, he falls asleep. And I'm like, how can you fall asleep when this is happening? And I'm just sitting there really nervous, because I'm like, okay, I can't see anything. I have this tiny lantern on the boat. I'm hearing all this noise. I'm like, what if they come right up to the boat and stick their head in and go, hey, Mom, what are you doing? You know, it was a really amazing experience. And that proved to me also that these animals are mostly nocturnal, because of the nighttime marsh sightings and the recordings I've gotten at night. I mean, it's perfect for them, because, I mean, there's nobody out there on the lake at night. I mean, I didn't see one boat. We were the only fruitcakes out there on the lake. So they're not stupid. They're not stupid. That's why they're so elusive, and they've, you know, survived this long. Mm. I believe that they have an extremely high intelligence, and their hearing range is phenomenal, because, you know, there's many stories. There was one. Matter of fact, Sandra Mancy's sighting, she had mentioned to me on the phone when I spoke with her, she said she had heard a boat coming right after the animal popped up out of the water. And she said its head turned and it was looking towards where this, you know, boat was coming from. Mm. And she didn't hear the boat at first. And then all of a sudden she started to, you know, get it in her lane of hearing. And she said the animal just dove down. And it was gone. And it knew that that boat was coming. And then there was another story in Westport, New York, where there was a gentleman driving in his car, and he saw a champ animal up on the beach. And when it heard his car, it kind of like freaked out and turned its head and looked around and went into the water. So they can hear way far more than us humans can hear. And I think that's part of their, you know, defense. That's part of their survival. They've got extremely good hearing, and any animal that can echolocate has super hearing anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it would be common sense to me, because of how big Lake Champlain is, that, you know, not only do these creatures have to vocalize across that distance, but they've got to be able to hear if anybody else responds.
Yes, absolutely. And there was, I'm trying to think, another hearing experience, eyewitness report that I'm trying to remember. There's so many. And it's like my head is always spinning, because I'm like, wait, which story and what date? But it's, I mean, with the hearing itself, I mean, it's just one of those things with sonar, okay? People will send me questions, of course, on Champ, and I love answering questions. And, you know, I had one person say, well, why don't they just have like 50 boats across the lake with sonar? Well, they did do that back in 1994. The Japanese came over here and they did a month-long search, and they actually did get a moving target on the sonar. And I actually have a picture of the printout from the sonar back then. And you can see where the animal was going along, and then all of a sudden it goes to the bottom. And then you see a little bit of it, and then it's gone. And I'm like, what in the world? Honestly, it looked like it buried itself in the sand or whatever. It buried itself. Because, I mean, it just disappeared. And they chased that for, I think it was like 15 minutes or something. And it was going faster than the boats. So, I mean, that's how fast that they can go. It's just, and it kind of, it gets me so mad, because like where I do my research, I know that they're there, but it's like, well, how are you going to get a tissue sample or something? They're so fast, you know? So I'm trying to develop a way to possibly attract one to the boat. I've got a few ideas. I'm not going to tell them yet, because kind of a secret, but it involves a piece of equipment that will possibly attract fish that will attract them, or will attract them alone. So hopefully that's one piece of equipment that I'm going to be getting this summer, and to try that out. Because, I mean, if we could figure out a way to do that, and then, you know, get a tissue sample. And my ultimate goal would be to tag them and track them around the lake. That would be amazing, like they do with, you know, sharks and with whales.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what you said there, because I know Ogopogo, there are a lot of people that have had encounters, and most of those, when they've been talking about what happened to them afterwards, say that it's, they think that the creature's being attracted because of the boat engine or because of the frequency of the, you know, how it resonates. So that's quite interesting that
That's kind of where I get, I'll be honest, that's where I got the idea from. It was remember the gentleman's name, what in the world was his name, him and his daughter, Ed Fletcher, that's the name. Ed Fletcher and his daughter were out on Okanagan, and that technology, that certain thing that they had on their boat is what I'm going to be getting for equipment. I'll just spill the beans, heck with it. And it's actually a box that emits a positive charge in the water. And each number of charge that, like, there's different options on the box, will attract different types of fish. Mm. You know, certain, like, say, frequency number 9 will attract sturgeon. Frequency this will, you know, it's different frequencies. So I'm hoping that that would be something that might work. But it's one of those things I try to keep secretive on most of my stuff, because I don't want a million people coming up here and harming them. And that's the thing, you know, with my champ protection law that I wrote, it's very important to me, because, you know, I'm sure, you know, over at Loch Ness, I think there was one gentleman that wanted to throw dynamite in Loch Ness.
Yes.
Just to prove Nessie was there. And I'm like, what a jerk, you know, but you get people like that because, you know, all they're thinking of is the fame and recognition of the whole thing. And I mean, as much as I want to be the one to discover this species in the lake, I care about the species, you know, and they're very rare. So the protection is the most important thing, and why I do my research is, you know, the health of the lake is very important to me. We have a lot of sewage getting in the lake, and it's just, it's unfortunate. And I mean, I'm sure that Champ is tough enough to get through that, but it's certainly not helping matters as far as the fish population. But yeah, I'm a big advocate about environmental. I'm always doing a lake cleanup day or things like that, just to help, because I mean, this is such a beautiful place, and it's a shame, you know, some people just don't care. They dump their garbage everywhere, and it's unfortunate.
It is. I mean, it is very important. I've been lucky enough to go to Loch Ness. I was also very lucky enough that it was sunny, which is almost as rare as Nessie in Scotland. And it was just one of the most beautiful places I've ever visited in my entire life. It was absolutely stunning.
I know, it's such a beautiful country there. I mean, the green, everything is just amazing. I can't wait to go, and I'm really looking forward to trying some of my, you know, research tactics there. That, you know, I know that there was a couple of recordings made. I believe one was during the Academy of Applied Sciences when they were doing research on Loch Ness. But, you know, I've been unable to find out where that tape went, and it was clicking, like echolocation. And I was curious to see if that was in any way similar to Champ or the same type of communication. But yeah, I've been unable to track where that tape went. So I believe it was Roy Mackle who supposedly had the tape, and then he passed away, and it was somewhere in his attic. And yeah, I just have not. And I even got a hold of Robert Rhines' son, Justice Rhines, and, you know, to talk to him to see if maybe he found a tape in his dad's belongings, and he had not. And he said, well, I will keep my eye out for you. So it's unfortunate, because I'd like to, you know, compare that to what I have. But when I do get out to Loch Ness, I'm definitely going to do my own recordings and hopefully maybe spend overnight in a boat or something. And that would be amazing to get something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Roy McCall's one of the people I'm very aware of. Mostly, however, due to his attempt to find Mekele Mbembe in the Congo. That's where yes. I know him from more than anything. I didn't realise he'd been over to Loch Ness.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember because there's like so much history with all the people that were involved in yeah. stuff. It was definitely a huge effort. And, you know, I find it fascinating because with Robert Rhines, there was a story, and I'm trying to remember, it's in my newspaper clippings. I have like 30 years of newspaper clippings that I need to scan and start posting to share with everybody. But there was one story that Wyckoff, I believe it was, he was supposed to come to Champlain. And something had happened. I believe Rhines was as well. This was back... Oh, Lord. I'm trying to remember. It was, the late 70s, I would say.
Yeah, that's somewhere in that. Yeah, because I certainly, that's when I first, because they were on a program that was shown in the UK where they were basically trying to do an expedition. So it's probably around that time because they were on about that they'd been yes. around the world looking for monsters. So, it's probably late 70s, I would suggest.
I mean, if I could sit here and go through all the newspaper clippings, I would. It might take me a while, but I will post it when I do find it. I'll have to scan it. But I found it really strange that, you know, Robert Rhines was a lawyer in Boston, Massachusetts, so he was pretty much a local.
Yeah.
So I was really surprised that he never did come to Champlain. He would always be over at Loch Ness because he had a house there called Thai Chat, and that was right at Temple Pier.
Yeah.
And I had planned and actually... staying at, well, he when he was still alive, shortly after he had passed away, I spoke to his son to see if I could, you know, spend a few nights there, and it was actually pretty reasonable for a few days. I was going to try to make like a group trip out of it, and then they ended up selling the house, and I was so sad. I'm like, damn it. Yeah. That would have been really great. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things with the sonar stuff. It's very, in my opinion, very invasive approach because those animals hear those boats. I mean, they yeah. hear that sonar. And when Operation Deep Scan happened, you know, what they failed to say was they didn't cover those bays on the sides.
Yep.
So basically, I think they were just pushing them into those bays, or they could be, you know, going up on land somewhere too and like into the marsh, because there is a marsh system near Urquhart Castle where there was a story of, I think it was in the 50s, of some school children that were over there, and they happened to see a Nessie come out of that marsh system into Loch Ness. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of unexplored areas of marsh there, but it's not 300,000 acres. There's not much. Because there's been stories too of a woman that saw one crossing a stream at night towards those marsh systems. And it's really interesting. Like I said, I think, you know, around Loch Ness, there's other lochs, Loch Lochy, Loch Oich, and, you know, they're very close proximity to each other. So who knows, at nighttime, nobody's out there. I mean, they could be going from one loch to another, and we wouldn't know it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you'll have a sighting, say in Loch Lochy, and then all of a sudden there's no sightings. It's like, okay. And then they'll do, like, say, you know, I mean, I've seen that in Canada as well. There's a lot of lakes up near Lake Okanagan that have had similar stories. And then we also have Lake Memphremagog, which is about 2 hours from here.
Yeah.
And there's stories of the same type of animal as Champ up there. And then the surrounding lakes next to Memphremagog have the same stories that pop up once in a while. So, yeah, I mean, they could be going from one lake to another at night and nobody would even know. So that's a theory.
Yeah, very much. Well, yeah, because that's Memphrey. Is it Memphrey?
Yes.
Yeah, because I think that's the one that everybody seems to forget about. But he's seen quite often. Well, I say he. We don't know. It is seen quite often up there.
Well, the thing that kind of annoys me is there's a lady that does the Memphrey. She doesn't go out and research. She's basically just a writer, and she collects a lot of the eyewitness reports. But what's unfortunate about that is that she doesn't share any of the reports with people. So it's like, why even bother collecting reports if you're not going to share them? And she's very protective of the Memfrey name. She actually copyrighted the name and threatened to sue people if they use the name on a T-shirt or whatever. Mm. And I'm like, how can you do that? That's a regional thing. You know, it's like me copywriting Champ and saying, oh, well, I own Champ. Like, that's a little ridiculous, you know. And it's sad because as a researcher, she should be more open with sharing, you know, her reports and stuff. That's what it's all about, is sharing that with people. And that's why you don't hear much about Memfrey, because she threatens to sue everybody. So it's kind of a sad thing. And she's up there in age. I think she's like 78. I was tempted to talk to her when I did go up there because she does work for the local historical society. But I just had like a bad feeling. Like, I've heard people say don't even bother because she gets really miserable about it. So I didn't bother at that point. But I am, you know, doing research up there as well this summer. I did a little bit when I was there the year before last. And I did try to get some recordings, which weren't successful, but I didn't bring my boat up there. I actually had a blow-up boat, and that was a nightmare. We had a heck of a time getting back to shore, so we're lucky we didn't get stuck out there. It was, we could only go out so far with the blow-up boat. So, yeah, I'm going to bring my research boat up there and see if I can get, you know, similar recordings to Champ, and that would be amazing as well.
Yeah, fantastic. So, you mentioned earlier on you had the privilege of speaking to the sadly departed Sandra Mansi, because she passed away last year, about a year ago, I think. What do you think about the Mansi incident?
Well, that photograph, I mean, when you look at that, there's no doubt in my mind that that is anything other than Champ. I mean, there's been theories of it's a floating log and all this nonsense. In my opinion, it's nonsense. And, you know, I had a head and neck sighting, and that was back in, when was that? I think it was 2005. I get my dates all mixed up because I've had so many darn experiences. So I'm like, okay, what year was that? I believe it was 2014. Mm. And my partner at the time and I were sitting at Button Bay, and he was looking through the spotting scope, and he said, hey, there's two Champs across the lake. And I said, you're full of it. You're out of your mind. And I looked, and it looked like two upturned boats, very similar to an, you know, a Nessie sighting.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, both of them started doing that vertical undulation, almost like a caterpillar on a table. That's as best as I can describe how they do this crawling motion. And the one in the front picked its head and neck up. And, oh, my God, I started crying, and I had a crappy camera at the time, unfortunately. I have a good one now, but I was trying to focus on this animal, and I'm bawling my eyes out, and it was so slow motion. I mean, so graceful, and it, when it came up, the neck was super long, and I said, how in the world is this animal holding its head up, head and neck up that high, you know, with being such a long neck?
Yeah.
And it looked more like an elasmosaur than it did a plesiosaur, very long and snake neck. And what I found really interesting was it had its chin up in the air, and I could see something in its mouth, and I believe it was a fish. So it was, because before, you know, they started doing that vertical undulation, there was fish jumping and like all excitedly I could see commotion going on in the water. And yeah, it had something in its mouth, and what it did, and I cry every time I tell the story because it was just amazing. And it ticks me off that I didn't get it on video. That's the worst part, because I'm like, no one's going to believe anything I'm saying because I don't have a video of it. But the top of the neck coiled right in a loop like a snake. And then when it had its chin up, it gulped down that fish. You could see the mouth open, almost like when you see a heron, you know, a blue heron bird, and they pick up a fish and they gulp it right down. That's exactly what it did. And then the neck uncoiled, and then it just gently, and just like slow motion, it went down in the water. And I was like, what the heck did I just see? And Dennis at the time was just all ecstatic because he's like, I told you I've seen the head neck. I told you. And he's laughing his head off. And I'm crying because I'm like, what the heck did I just see? But that proved to me that, you know, the surface videos of, you know, the back and everything that I had gotten wasn't, a giant eel or a wave or a log or anything like that. It really, it proved to me what I've been filming and recording as well is definitely them. And the famous video, actually, I shouldn't get into that first. We were talking about Mansi's photo.
That's okay.
That, yeah, sorry about that.
That's all right.
That, the head and neck in that photo is exactly what I saw, except in that photo, it looks like a short neck. Mm. But what I believe is that neck loops around.
Mm.
If you look, if you look in that photo and you blow it up, you can actually see that that neck is not connected where it looks like it's connected.
Yeah.
So it's basically looping around. And, like, I would have to point it out to you. I think on my paper I did, I don't think, I'm not sure if I did or not. I might have put, like, a diagram of what I believe.
Yeah.
You know, the neck is only, it's only showing a portion of the neck, in other words.
Yeah, very
But,
much
yeah, so. That's definitely that picture is definitely the real deal, and the horns on the top of its head that they call them, mm. you can actually see that there's a knob right behind the eye, and that looks very much like that parotid gland of the salamander. So yeah. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it is.
So, I mean, I don't know of any log that has those physical characteristics, you know?
Yeah, no, I remember seeing that where they basically, it was a floating tree stump, I think it was. That they said, because I felt, I was talking to Seth and Adam from Small Town Monsters, and obviously we were talking about Champ, he came up, and I was on about Sandra Mansi as one of those people that's been brave enough to come forward, and she spent 30 years of her life just being called every name under the sun.
Yes. Which is unfortunate. It's you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I mean, that photo has been analyzed over and over and proven not to be any type of fabrication. You yeah. know, it's not like she's, oh, let me go send my husband out on an inner tube and take a picture
yeah.
and say it's Champ, you know. It's yeah, it's unfortunate that people can be very shallow minded, but you know, I guess if you haven't seen it for yourself, you know, there are some people that will be doubters, you know.
Yeah, very true. I mean, and it is unfortunate because, you know, obviously Sandra was always very accommodating. She's appeared on numerous programs and done numerous interviews. And half the time she was just made to look like a complete idiot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really a shame. And you know, it's one of those things here in Vermont. You would think, you know, at Loch Ness, as you know, there's so much tourism involved. There's
yes.
stores everywhere. Nessie this, Nessie that. And here in Vermont, you know, once in a while you'll see a place that'll be called Champ's, like say Champ's Car Wash, or there's a place in Burlington where they sell, they do vaping, you know, the yep. vaping cigarettes, and it's called Champ's Vapes, and it has a picture of Champ blowing like vape out of his mouth. And you know, there's very few. It's funny. There's very few things about Champ here, and it is just very strange to me because it's such an amazing treasure of this area that people are just so. They think it's baloney, you know, and it's sad, but it's funny because I will run into people that will see my, you know, Champ sign on my car that says Champ Search. And, I mean, 99% of people will leave. And then you'll get kind of a rude person that will come up and go, oh, well, that's stupid or whatever. And I just laugh at them. And I tell them, I'm like, hey, I've recorded echolocation in the lake. And, hey, I don't blame you if you don't believe if you've never seen anything. But, you know, sometimes you will get the occasional, you know, person who you want to knock out, but you're like, oh, whatever. You know, you can't, you get, and as you know, you have to have thick skin in this field, as you know. So, because one day it's something's going to happen, whether one's going to wash up, something is going to happen. And I sure hope it would be needed to find that, because I'm all about the protection of the animals too. And people don't think of that. They're just like, oh, well, if they're really out there, what is a law going to do? Or like I had someone that had told me that when I presented the idea of writing a new Champ law, and he's like, oh, that'll never happen. It'll never happen. Well, it did. And I did write the new law for Champ, and I actually sent it to him, and he was like, oh, I'm really sorry that I doubted you. So
Yeah, I mean, it is strange. I mean, I've spoken to a few people over the years, even before I started this podcast, about certain areas that have become well known and connected. You know, if you say Point Pleasant, people know you're thinking about Mothman, Nessie. You know, straight away we talked about Loch Ness, and obviously nowadays it seems. I mean, there's a new term been coined called crypto tourism, where certain areas are really pushing it. And like you say, Loch Ness, if you go there, it has, I think there's three or four areas that you can go. There's a museum, there's photos everywhere. It knows for a fact that the reason people come to that area of Scotland is that people just want to have a look and see if, even if they know it, even if they don't believe it, they just want to be where Nessie's supposed to be. So I find it very surprising that certain places just don't embrace these, even if it is something. Like I was talking to Alexander last week, we ended up mentioning the Dover Demon, which is one of the strangest cryptids I've ever heard of. Even things like that, the Jersey Devil, and weird, really weird things. People will visit that place just to see it.
Yeah, and it's weird because, like I said, in Vermont, there's a couple places that there's an aquarium in Burlington that they have a Champ exhibit, and it's so old. I mean, they have not updated it. It's been the same. I mean, they have like a glass case with the Mansi photo, well, a copy of the Mansi photo in it, and then they have a bag of Champ chips, like an empty bag of chips. I have no idea. It's kind of dumb because excuse me, there's so much to show now. I mean, the recordings, the videos, and it's so weird that not once have I heard anything from them where they were in remotely interested. And I'm just like, what? They don't know what they're missing, and they don't understand that that would be such a big business for them, for people to come in, because anytime I've ever gone to that place, there's little kids running by yelling, champ, champ, champ. And I'm like, man, there could be so much more to offer, education-wise. I mean, they have like a science exhibit showing planets. Well, what the heck does that have to do with the lake? It's really strange because it's supposed to be an aquarium that is all about Lake Champlain. So I have no idea, but they really need to change their strategy and get the champ stuff out there more. And I think they would really benefit from that. And I think the whole state of Vermont should be doing the same thing. Because when you go over to New York, there's Port Henry, the home of Champ. And I mean, even there, I mean, they have the Champ sighting sign. They have a Champ Day every year. But, it's just, it's not that popular.
It is strange because even another place I can think of over here we've got in the UK is obviously Rendlesham, which is a very overly discussed and investigated alleged UFO incident that happened in 1980. And the local council there ended up building a trail in the woods where the incident was supposed to happen. So even though quite a lot of people doubt the veracity of the story, they've still embraced it because they know people are coming from all over the world to visit Rendlesham because of this story that's nearly 40 years old.
Yes.
Oh dear. I don't, yeah, I'm with you, Katie. I'm
Yeah, I mean, at
perplexed.
least they're well, at least they're smart about it, and it's just, I mean, Vermont's kind of a weird state anyway. I hate to say it because I live here, but I mean, there's a lot of snobs here. It's true. And like, you'll go over to New York State on the other side of the lake, and I mean, the people are just so different from here. Like, over here, they're kind of like got their nose stuck up in the air, and it's kind of one of those weird things. A lot of wealthy people this side of the lake, and I was like, darn, maybe I should have moved to New York. But this is my research area, so I try, I basically stuck with that. Because if I go, say, if I went up to Burlington, and I mean, I do research up there as well, but if I did move to Burlington or something like that, then I'd have to start all over and figure out where are the best places to look for Champ. And I believe that the lake is populated by different families of them, different groups in different areas. So you know, we've got the Button Bay family here, you know, three or four of them cruising around from Button Bay all the way to basically Basin Harbor area, Shelburne, Vermont. So, yeah, that's the Champ family that I deal with is down this way. And, you know, it's yeah, I have to kind of start all over. I mean, to do all that work up there, although I have gotten one video up there at the mouth of the Winooski River of a Champ animal. And yeah, that was really interesting because we were actually filming for the Small Town Monsters. And it was so funny because Alex was doing an interview with someone and I said, oh, I'm going to go over to the bridge and kind of hang out and keep an eye out for Champ while you guys are doing that. And then all of a sudden I look and I'm like, what the heck is that? Is that a log or something? And then, I mean, it was animate. It was going right to left. And I said, oh my God. So I got my camera out and got a video of that. And then as soon as a boat came into view, it submerged. So I know it wasn't just a floating log or anything like that. And that was actually the first video that I had gotten in a different location than my research location. And that was around probably 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So it was very sunny out that day. So I believe it was just basically the surface basking in the sun, getting his vitamin D. but it's amazing. And you know, it's funny because when I tell my experiences, I'm like, people are going to think I'm a total crackpot. But I mean, I have the videos to show and the echolocation recordings. So I can't be all that nuts, you know?
Absolutely. And to be fair, I know you, when we were talking about Sandra a bit ago, you mentioned a video. Now, I've seen a very it might not be the same one you're thinking of. And I think it was it taken by a chap called Dicker Falter?
Yep, that's the video.
Ah, right, because he was, it was with his son.
Yeah,
Pete,
Peter Baudet and Dick Falter.
Yeah.
Yep.
Carry on, go on.
that was an amazing video. What's really interesting about that video, too, is that for about 2 seconds, I think, on ABC News when they showed that clip, they actually show the surface video, like kind of, Not the clip where it comes up right next to the boat and you see it looks like an appendage, but when I enhance that, it actually is a head and it opens its mouth up. You can actually see it looks just like a horse's head, like I said before. But what's really interesting is on the surface, a little bit away from the boat, they show like 2 seconds of this video of that caterpillar crawl motion. And I'm actually going to do a comparison of that to, you know, different stills from my videos. Yeah. And it's the same exact thing. And that amazed me too, because I'm like, okay, I had my head and neck sighting. I saw them doing that vertical undulation before it happened. Then I watched the Baudet video and I paused it at that very second where they show, you know, them at the surface doing that crawling motion. And that just proves right there that what I'm getting is not a fish, not a log. It's really, really interesting. But what's really sad is, you know, that video, they only show a portion of what they took on that video. And supposedly it's in some kind of safety deposit box and they want like $10,000 or $15,000 to gain access to it. So it's like, no one's going to pay that kind of money. It's been sitting in there for how long has it been now? I think that was 2005.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely mid last decade. I think it's 2005. Yeah.
So it's like, what good is it sitting in a box? You know, I mean, I would love to see that video in its entirety. I mean, that would be amazing to see.
Yeah, I think that fake alien footage from the 1990s has caused a lot of problems when we've got footage of other things, because people think, oh, straight away we can be rich overnight, and unfortunately a lot of the alien autopsy video scared a lot of people off, I think, more than encouraged it.
Yeah, definitely. And I always said if I get that head and neck video, you know, the first place I would go would be my lawyer's office to you know, to put a copyright on it. Because, absolutely. I mean, so many people will be like, oh, I took that video. And, you know, it's just one of those things that I want it, you know, a protected piece of evidence there. And I think that that's important because, I mean, it's unfortunate. Like, that does happen. Someone will take a video or a picture of something and they'll claim it. They'll say, oh, this other person shows up. Oh, I took that. So yeah, you have to be smart about that stuff and protect yourself, that's for sure.
Absolutely. It always amazes me that we have to sort of bring in intellectual property when we're dealing with cryptids these days.
Yeah, and it's one of those things too. It's like in the Bigfoot world, there's, people, there's a few out there that'll say, oh, there's a Sasquatch and it's a stump. And I'm like, oh, man, I don't say anything, but,
yep.
You definitely keep those things out there. And that's what makes, the honest people look bad, unfortunately, is people like that, like Rick Dyer with the dead Bigfoot hoax and the Bigfoot body he was trailing around with, saying that's what it was, and ended up being a suit, so yes. And animal parts.
Famously. That one. I mean, there's another guy that's claimed he's got a head. There's obviously someone else who I won't mention whose footage is clearly puppets. And not very good ones at that, because they look like Ewoks. It's so frustrating. It's one of those things, Katie, that sadly this field, at the end of the day, it's going to attract things, especially with YouTube, because things can just go viral so quickly. And if someone claims that that's theirs, it doesn't really matter, because within hours they'll have made a fortune on YouTube.
Yes. It's crazy. So, no matter what video I get, there's always going to be someone out there saying, oh, well, she made some kind of thing that looks like a head and neck. I mean, unfortunately, that's what you're going to run into. And, to find a biological specimen would be the ultimate thing. But then you also have to, if I did get something like that, I would not release the whole specimen. I would keep most of it and just a little piece, say if it was tissue or whatever, because there's stories of that too, where people have found, say, hair, Sasquatch hair or whatever, and we lost it, you always have to protect yourself in that matter. I actually had a dream one time that the government was at my house, kind of like the Men in Black, because I had a chant video that was like very up close, and I woke up and I'm like, oh my God, that's scary. Like, you think about that and you wonder if it would be treated the same as like the UFO type of conspiracies, I really don't think it would, but you just never know.
Yeah. Straight. Well, once you enter the world of cryptozoology, strange things happen regardless. I think, Katie, it's one of those things that synchronicity and weirdness tend to appear more once you make that decision to put your hat on a certain subject and chase it.
Yes, I agree, definitely.
So what's next for you then? So how long are you planning on working on this year then? So what's your normal weekly routine when you're out looking for champ?
Oh gosh, well, usually I will get up super early in the morning, around 4:30, get up, get a breakfast sandwich, go to the lake and sit for 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah.
Then I will come home, and sometimes around noontime I'll go back and do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then usually the best time is between 5 and 8:30 at night.
Yeah.
So that's like my prime time that I like to be out there, either on the shore or in my boat or whatever. I kind of mix it up. I actually do more shore searching than anything, because the problem is with the boat, you'll get out there in the boat and something could be, basically it's level with you, your water level.
Mm.
So it's very hard to see anything from a long distance if you're in the boat. Plus, you're in the boat and it's kind of tipsing back and forth. And you know how hard it is to video from a boat? I mean, even if you have the tripod, you're all over the place.
Yep.
So I do a lot of like shore work, and then to go out in the boat, that's basically the hydrophone work and things like that. And then sometimes if I'm really ambitious that day and I'm not totally wiped out from being tired, I will take a little bit of a nap, and then I'll get back up around midnight and go out and do the research out in the marsh system with, I have a high powered light. I have, cause these animals give off a nocturnal eye shine. So I have this high powered light where I'll shoot that out in the locations and look for any sort of eye shine, I also have a thermal imaging camera, a night vision monocular, which I love, to get any video with that as well. And I'm actually thinking of doing a new experiment this summer where I'm going to take like a digital recorder and put it out in one of these marsh systems for like 2 or 3 days and just record and see if I hear anything in the marsh. I mean, since they vocalize underwater, you would think that they vocalize out of water as well. Mm. So that's an interesting thing. If, you know, they make any type of bellowing noise like alligators do, I don't know. I mean, it would just be kind of neat to try that because that's never been tried before. So that's one of the plans. And the season has just started here on the lake. When the water reaches around 50 degrees Fahrenheit is when the sightings start occurring. That's when your frogs are coming out, the turtles are out, and right now in the last week and a half the frogs have come out, and I got so excited. I had my window open and I'm like, wait a minute, I hear peep frogs. I was so excited. I'm like, yes, Champ's gonna be coming out, ta-da. So this is when the season begins, and it goes all the way until October. And that's when things start dying down. And I believe it's because of the lake temperature.
Yeah.
If they are ectothermic, that's when they are most active, June, July, August, and into September. Hmm. Then once the water starts dropping down cooler in temperatures, I believe they go into like a torpor, like a type of torpor mode where they're slower. Yeah. And then I believe they probably bury themselves at the bottom and hibernate just like the aquatic frogs and turtles do. So it's going to be a busy summer for sure. And I'm also going to be at a lot of events this year. I believe we're going to be doing something down in Kentucky. I can't remember. There's like so many different events that we'll be attending. And in October, I'll be doing a seminar at Chautauqua Lake, which is in New York State. Mm-hmm. And it's a Bigfoot event, but I'm actually the only one to talk about the lake monster. So that will be interesting to be in the realm of Bigfoot people.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited about it. I think, it's my goal to get the Champ thing out there more in the public eye and for people to understand the facts about it more than just the legends of it.
Absolutely. Well, I can't wish you anything but the very best of luck, Katie. I've followed your work and your progress for a couple of years, and I'm always excited to see you when you're out and about. So where can everybody keep up to date with everything? How can they find your work? What's the best place for people to find out more?
Well, I think probably the best place to keep up to date with my work is to go to my Champ Search page on Facebook. So if they just type in Champ Search, it should pop up. And I usually do live videos, up-to-date research. And that's the best way to basically follow the whole Trail of Champ thing. And then I also have a website, which I try to update on a regular basis. But that's probably not the best way to, you know, go about following the everyday stuff. But the website itself is www.officialchampsearch.webs.com. And my book, Water Horse of Lake Champlain 2, that is available on Amazon.com as well. And I'm actually working on, gosh, I have too many irons in the fire. I have a children's book on Champ.
Yeah.
That will be coming out soon. And then I have a couple of other books. One of them will be Water Horse of Lake Champlain, The Search. That's going to be a really good book because it's basically going to be more of the Champ evidence that I've gotten, the videos and the echolocation recordings. And, you know, there'll be different eyewitness reports in that book as well, but it's basically more about the search. So I think that's going to be a really fun read.
Brilliant. Well, like I say, I've followed the Champ for many a year, and I'm delighted that we've had the chance to have a chat about it because I just love it, and I'm eagerly awaiting. I hope to God that you find something soon, no matter how long it takes, Tatey. So keep safe, keep searching, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for your support as always, and thank you very much for having me on the show. I had a great time.
Oh, my pleasure. You take care, Katie. All the best.
All right, you as well. Have a wonderful day.